which is to be your speaker for tonight. She is terrific. Betty.
Thank you, Virginia. My name is Betty Brown, and I'm a faithful member of the Chagrin Valley Al-Anon Group back near Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, everybody. I'd like to thank the committee for asking Tom and I to come together and share this weekend with you. As we all know, alcoholism is a family disease. And Tom and I got sick together, and today we're both trying to get well together. And so, as I say, with the help of God, AA and Al-Anon, we have been able to rebuild our lives and recapture a love that was practically destroyed because of the alcoholism. So I truly am grateful to be here. It's a beautiful place for a conference. When I first met Tom, I was a divorcee. I had an 11-year-old daughter by the name of Sandy. Sandy, of course, today is a happily married young lady, 35 years old. She's not too young. I hate to admit that. Oh, I didn't mean it. But Sandy, after Tom and I were married, Tom legally adopted Sandy. And she is a very beautiful young lady. And I'd like to tell you that Sandy just graduated from law school. She has a peach of a husband and three beautiful children. And yet she had this great desire and determination, after having her family, to become a lawyer. And she just got back from taking the bar exam in Columbus, Ohio. And Tom and I are extremely proud of her. She is already the assistant county prosecutor of Lake County. And so, as I say, we really are very proud of her. Now, Tom and I had three more daughters after we were married, and their ages today are 18 and a half, 20, and 21 and a half. And they're beautiful girls. They're really the joy of our lives, I must tell you, because they seem to be happy, well-adjusted kids, and young ladies. And truly, they, you know, that's not so easy to say in this day and age with the way things are going in the world. And so here again, Tom and I are extremely grateful to our God for guiding these children. When I first met Tom, I knew that he drank a lot, but that really didn't bother me a whole lot because I enjoyed drinking myself back in those days. And I could keep up with him pretty well, you know, he kind of liked that. And we had, I guess, what you'd call a whirlwind courtship that lasted for about 10 months. We did a lot of partying, a lot of night clubbing, and just really we're having a ball. But you know, even then, Tom's drinking was causing problems between us. We were having arguments even then. So when he finally proposed marriage, I told him that I loved him, but I turned him down. I said, no, I really didn't think we could make it. I thought he drank too much. And he said to me, why, Betty, if that's the only problem we have, I'll quit drinking. And I didn't know a thing about alcoholism, as you well know. And he did quit for several months, you know. So we went ahead with our plans, and we had a beautiful wedding at the country club. And with all the champagne and booze and everything there, Tom never touched a drop, even on our wedding day. And again, I felt very proud, and I thought, gee, I really have it made, you know. But when we got to New York, Carol, on our honeymoon, Tom had apparently called ahead to the hotel. And when we arrived, there were all these bottles of champagne on ice. And I remember saying to him, well, what's with the champagne, Tom? I thought you quit drinking. And he said, well, my word, Betty, after all, it's our honeymoon. And I haven't had a drink in 4 or 5 months, whatever it was. And that made sense. And I think he said something like, a little wine never hurt anybody. And he proceeded to pop those corks and drink that champagne. Well, I'll tell you, that night it took 3 bellhops to pick him up off the floor in the lobby of that hotel and get him to bed. He's a big guy, you know. Well, here it was, our honeymoon night, and there he lay snoring away, passed out. And I had greater things in mind. Well, needless to tell you, we really don't talk about that honeymoon too often, because the rest of it really was pretty much the same the whole time. He was bombed. And so, of course, when we got back from this honeymoon, Tom knew how very, very disillusioned I was. He couldn't help but know I didn't talk to him all the way back. And so at this time, he made a conscious effort to control his drinking, and we've talked about it, and I suppose that this is probably when he became a periodic drinker. And it wasn't too bad in the beginning, because every time he felt like drinking, he would take me with him. And we were still having a little bit of fun. And of course, I loved the dinners out and the soft lights and the music, too. And but you know, looking back, after a few years of this, it started to become more trouble than fun. And we would start out lovey-dovey, you know, and it would be honey this and honey that. And you know, by midnight, we were ready to kill each other. And yeah, we'd wind up in these awful arguments. And most of the time, I would take a cab and go on home, because Tom wasn't ready to quit drinking. And so, at this time in my life, I decided that it wasn't any fun anymore, and I didn't want to drink anymore. And it was around this time, anyway, that we started to have babies. And that's a whole story in itself. Some of you here know that Tom played pro football with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he told me that a doctor once told him that due to a slight football injury, it had left him sterile. And right off the bat, you know, we had 3 babies within 3 years. And I said, it's a good thing you're sterile, you know. I don't think I really trusted him from then on. But anyhow, after we had the babies, I really developed a guilty feeling about leaving them to go drinking. And so I really did quit drinking. And I've always said, but for the grace of God, you know, I'm grateful that I did quit at that time. And of course, deep down, I really thought if I quit, maybe he would too. And we all know that didn't happen. And so now Tom went on to drink alone, and it seems to me that this is when our real troubles began. I know today that the progression of the disease of alcoholism really took hold, and it was all going downhill. And there were the smash cars and the DWIs and the jails and so forth. And when I think back, the more Tom drank, something began to happen to me, actually. I began to get sick, and I don't mean physically. Because, you know, I'd always been a really happy-go-lucky kind of a person. Nothing really bothered me a whole lot. And I realized that my entire personality began to change. And I became more sullen and more unhappy and depressed. And the self-pity began to creep in. And I always thought God was punishing me for something that I had done in my past. I couldn't understand why this was happening. And the resentments, they were horrible. I resented everything he did or said. I even resented the fact that, you know, sometimes he'd have to take a customer to lunch, and I would be at home with 3 little babies hanging on, maybe ironing on a hot day, and I think, sure, there he is. Some nice air-conditioned restaurant, you know. And I never once gave it a thought that this was our bread and butter. I mean, this was part of his job. And I think worst of all was the non-trust and the suspicions that absolutely enveloped me. I didn't trust Tom from here to that door. And I was constantly checking up on him at this period and trying to find out where he'd been, where, you know, what he was doing. And it was a miserable way to live, really. And I began to withdraw from all my friends. I sure didn't want them to know how dumb I'd been, you know. And I especially didn't want my family to find out what was happening. Because, you see, my oldest brother is the one that introduced Tom and I at a party at one of the local clubs. And when he found out that we were getting serious about one another, he took me aside one night and he said, "Betty, what's the matter with you? Are you crazy?" He said, "Don't you know this guy is a lush?" And, you know, it really upset me because I always hated that expression. And second of all, my brother drank more than Tom. And I really felt this was the pot calling the kettle black, you know. And so, you know, I have to tell you that a few years ago, I had an occasion to see this brother. After my parents died, our family just kind of fell apart. And I had not seen this brother in a good many years. But one morning I had an occasion to meet him for coffee. And you know, when I saw him, I was so filled with compassion for him. I can't explain it. He was sick and nervous and bloodshot eyes and just all hungover. And I couldn't help but think while I was looking at him, you know, that here sits the pot, you know, still getting drunk, still causing problems for himself and his family. And the kettle, who had sobered up many years before in AA, was at home, happy, living a good and a productive life. And I know, really, that it's not up to me to say whether my brother is or is not an alcoholic. But a friend of mine always says, if you see something that looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, you can be pretty sure it's a duck, you know. And so I'm pretty sure that my brother is an alcoholic. And I only hope to God that maybe someday before it's too late, maybe he'll find what Tom and I have going for us today. And getting back to my story, our home was a very, very unhappy place to live because I was always in a state of frustration trying to control Tom's drinking. The more he drank, the sicker I got, and I realized that today. And I think it was around this time that I started the parking lot bit. Now, I don't know if any of you gals ever did this, but when Tom was out drinking, I would go looking for his car in all the parking lots of the local taverns and bars, you know? And sometimes I'd find it, and sometimes I wouldn't. But I'll tell you, on the nights that I would find his car, you wouldn't believe it. I would stomp into that bar and raise holy hell. And I would just scream and swear and carry on and knock the drinks off the bar. And it was terrible, you know. And we're sort of like Mutt and Jeff anyway, you know. But I wouldn't have cared if I got killed on the spot. I would be so furious. And I always felt that if I could just humiliate him enough, he would stop this nonsense and come home, you know. And I'm surely not proud of that today because I realized that the only person I ever humiliated was myself. And I know without a doubt the guys in that bar must have said, "Jesus, no wonder he drank," you know. But anyway, then, on the nights that I would not find his car, I would go home and take up my post. And that was sitting on top of the clothes dryer. Now, I have to explain that to you because, see, at that time we lived in an L-shaped house and all the major rooms faced the backyard. And the only rooms that faced the driveway and the road were the children's bedrooms and the utility room. And outside the utility room window, we had some shrubbery planted, and of course you can see how short I am. I couldn't see over the shrubbery unless I got up on top of the dryer. And this is where I spend hours and hours, sitting, waiting for the lights of his car to come down that road. And we talk about the family disease and the insanity that goes with it. And I'll tell you, I can remember, almost as though it were yesterday, some of the distorted, exaggerated thoughts, you know, that would go through my mind. And I would start out thinking, and this didn't happen once or twice, it happened many times. And I'd start out thinking, you know, I'd be furious to begin with. That anger would just creep in, and I think that dirty rat, you know, he's probably out there having a good time dancing with some good-looking gal. And I think to myself, how dare he do this to me? You know, how dare he? And then, you know, my thoughts as it got later would turn to worse things than that. And I'd sit there and I'd cry and cry. And then pretty soon, I think, oh my God, maybe he's been in an accident. So I'd hop off the dryer and go put a little lipstick on, comb my hair in case I got called to the hospital. And then pretty soon I'd think to myself, I hope the hell he is in the hospital. And I hope he has two broken legs. Funny when I think about it. You know, I've heard a lot of gals say in Al-Anon that when their husbands were drinking, they wished them dead. But in all honesty, I never did wish him dead, but I sure wished him a lot of broken legs. I used to feel or envision in my mind that if he were completely immobile, number one, he couldn't drink, and number two, he'd have a lot of time to lay there and think about what he'd been doing to me. And it was always what he was doing to me. You know, I never, ever once gave it a thought as to what he was doing to himself. And then pretty soon, it would start to be almost daybreak, you know, and I'd think to myself, well, maybe he's in jail again. And that's okay, too, because I wouldn't lift a finger to help him again. But do you know that within the next few moments, my mind would be wondering where I could borrow $200 or $300 that time of morning in case I had to go get him out. Now, you know, these things, I never once gave it a thought that this was abnormal in any way. I don't really know what I thought, but this is the illness and the distorted kind of thinking that went on in my mind in those days. And then finally, when Tom would pull in at daybreak, if I were lucky, I would be so relieved, you know, that he made it safe and sound. But by the time he got out of that car and got to the front door, all that anger was back, you know. And I would be at that door, ready to pounce, just like a tiger. You wouldn't believe it. And, you know, just in all that anger, there's a guy I heard from Pittsburgh once say, he always thought his wife's mouth was connected to the doorknob. I know without a doubt Tom must have had those same feelings, because the minute he hit that door, I'd be all over him just like a tiger. And I would punch and scratch and kick and swear and just carry on, you know. You might wonder how I even got away with that, as big as Tom is, you know. But he's always said that somehow in the back of his mind, drunk or sober, he kind of knew if he ever once punched me, he'd probably kill me, you know. And he would have, I'm sure. So therefore, he'd kind of stick his hand on the top of my head, you know. You know, all he wanted to do was go in and go to bed. And he'd say to me, why don't you get off my back, you know. And there's no way I'd let him go in and go to bed. Not until he heard everything I had rehearsed all night long in my mind, right? And then, you know, the next day, he'd get up and I'd say to him, and don't you dare forget what I told you last night. And he'd look at me with a blank stare. And I was too dumb to realize that there was no way in God's world he could remember what I had told him the night before, you know. And so this is the way our lives were going. And it really was an awful place. It was just one big argument now. And Tom had to go to Indiana on a business trip. And when he took his last drink, and I always say I pray to God it really was his last drink. But he had to you know, I told you a minute ago I didn't trust him from here to that door, let alone, you know, to let him go out of town. But I had no choice. He had to go. And so he was to leave like in the morning and come back late the following afternoon. And so before he left, of course, I'd get the Bible and make him swear on the Bible that he wouldn't drink. And then I'd line up all these little kids and make them swear on their heads that he wouldn't drink. And you talk about sick. And then I would be furious, you know, when he didn't keep that promise. I'd say, how could he do that to these beautiful children? And so when Tom didn't get home the following day at the estimated time of arrival, I knew, because I waited a few more hours, and when I didn't hear a word from him, then I was positive he was drinking again. Because Tom's always been a very reliable and prompt person when he wasn't drinking. And you know, something happened to me at this time in my life. I began to walk the floor. I realized today that I hit my own bottom. And in walking the floor and thinking about our lives together, I really realized that even though there was a little bit of love left, I just could no longer live like this. And I wasn't going to raise the children like this. And so I made a decision that night to divorce Tom. And it was as though a calm had come over me. So when he finally got home a day or two later, whatever it was, I very calmly and very quietly told him that if he didn't get his clothes and leave, the children and I were going to leave, and we were all packed and ready to go. And I think for the very first time, Tom knew that I was whipped, and he knew that I was serious, that I really meant it. Because, you see, I had threatened him hundreds of times to leave, you know, and he'd say, go ahead, who needs you, you know, and he'd say lovely things like, don't let the door hit you on the way out, you know. And I'd cry, and I really believed that he didn't love me at all anymore. But this time, it was different. And I realized, too, and I've always said this, that because of all the broken promises and the lies and the fights and the alcoholism, Tom and I really, by this time, had drifted so far apart that I don't think he really would have cared a whole lot if he'd have lost me. But he has always adored the children, and he didn't want to lose those kids. And so he began to plead with me about one last chance. And we went round and round till daybreak. And finally, Tom said to me, Betty, I will do anything you ask if you'll just give me one more chance. And I whirled around and I said, only if you join AA. Now, you know, all my life I've believed in a higher power, and I choose to call him God. And I know without a doubt that God put those words in my mouth that day at the right time. I mean, to drop dead, you know. But he didn't, and he called AA. And we began to go to AA meetings. And I always say at this point in my story, I wish I could tell you we walked off hand in hand into the sunset and sit down. But of course, that only happens in movies, you know. And we had an awful lot of adjustments to make, both of us. A lot of problems to overcome. I went to a meeting with Tom every single night for the first year and a half or 2 years, I think. And it was, I loved it. And he was sober probably almost 2 years, I think. And I couldn't understand why things were not all that great in our house. And believe it or not, we were now fighting and arguing as much as we did when he drank. And this I couldn't understand, because I'd always said if he would only quit drinking, he's a wonderful guy, we'd be so happy. And now he was sober and we were not all that happy. And the funny part of my story is, now I have to backtrack and tell you, that by this time I already had some Al-Anon. And I think Tom was sober, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And I had not heard a single word about Al-Anon, would you believe that? Until one night a friend of mine invited me to go to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And I remember saying to her, well, Marge, what is Al-Anon? And she said, Betty, it's a program for ourselves. It's a program to improve ourselves. And I remember thinking, how he improved perfection, you know. It's a little exaggerated, but not much, I tell you. Because you see, I had really felt that I had been a good wife and mother, and housekeeper, stayed home and took care of the kids, minded my own business. And if anybody needed improving, it was him, not me, you know. I could not see the things in myself at that time. I had not even been aware of the fact that by this time I'd become a pretty good liar. I was always covering up and lying for Tom, to the bill collectors, to his employers, to our friends, family. And I wasn't even aware of the fact that by this time I'd become a pretty good thief, too. Now I have to clarify that one, because in all my life, I don't ever remember, you know, ever stealing anything from anybody else. But when Tom came home drunk and passed out, I would go through his pockets and steal everything I could get my hands on. And I justified it. You know, I didn't see a thing wrong with this. I just felt if he could spend his money on his drunken friends, then certainly I could just help myself to whatever was left over. You know, I can still picture myself sneaking in the dark and lifting the wallet. I said I started to feel like Betty the Dip. You know, I was good at it. But anyhow, oh, the best part was the next day, if he dared to ask me, you know, I'd look him right in the eye and convince him that he had spent it, you know. And I'm not proud of these things, believe me. They're sort of funny in a way, but they're degrading too when I think about it. But anyway, this is the way it was. And I wasn't aware of these things about myself. And I had such a mouth that I could, you know, cut Tom in half with two words. But anyhow, I agreed to go to that first Al-Anon meeting with Marge. And that night, they had a discussion on our four-step inventory. Now, you know, we know that that probably would be a rather confusing kind of a meeting for a brand new person. But it wasn't to me, simply because by this time, I had already heard this step discussed at AA meetings with Tom. And around our dining room table, we brought people home with us after the meeting. And so I was well aware of what they were talking about. But it was a little bit shocking because, you see, when they talked about it at the AA meeting, I thought that was great for Tom. And I'd even nudge him with my knee if we sat next to, you know, making sure, you know, that he was paying attention to what was going on. But now they're telling me to take my own inventory. And this was something a little different. Well, I thought about it. That night after the meeting, I began to take my own inventory. And I did it in my head at the time. Our literature, of course, tells us to take a written inventory, and I've certainly done that since a couple of times. But at the time, it was at least a beginning for me. And it was the first time in my whole life that I'd ever taken a true, honest look at Betty Brown. And I was not too happy. As most of us know, sometimes it's a little painful because it made me realize right then and there that I wasn't the person that I pretended to be or the person that other people thought I was. And it was sort of like what Tracy said tonight, It was sort of like putting on and taking off a mask or the smile. And you know, people would say to Tom, gee, you've got a wonderful wife. She's so pleasant. She comes to all these meetings, you know. But like I say, they did not know me when I got home. And I would revert to the same critical, nasty disposition that I had always had. And so, as I say, at least that was a beginning for me. Now, I went to Al-Anon, probably for about a year and a half, I think. And I made some feeble attempts at working the steps. But, you know, it was funny because the things that I did not think applied to me, I just threw them out and only used what I thought applied to me. And like getting into the steps, our fifth step, sure, I did the inventory. But admitting to God and to myself and to another human being, I remember thinking to myself, admit to another, why, it's nobody's business what I did, you see. I was missing the whole point. Or making a list of all persons I had harmed. And I can remember thinking, if I harmed anybody, they probably had it coming, you know. And yeah, this is the kind of a program I was trying to work and could not understand why I wasn't getting happier and why things were not working for me. And so finally, after a period of time, apparently I still wasn't thoroughly convinced, you know, that I really needed Al-Anon. And so I dropped out for a while. And I didn't think that there was any change in me when I went to Al-Anon, but apparently there was, because after I dropped out, every time Tom and I got into an argument, he'd say to me, you better get back to Al-Anon. And I'd say, you better take your own inventory, you know, that kind of stuff. So there was a difference. But then there was, as I say, things were, here again, just, I was really not a happy person. And even after 2 years of sobriety, thoughts of divorce were running through my mind, and that's kind of sad. But anyhow, it was about this time that we went to one of our early Cook Forest AA conferences up in Pennsylvania. And it was there that I heard a most wonderful Al-Anon speaker by the name of Marcy W. from Texas. And Marcy today is my long-distance sponsor. And this was in the spring, this was in May of 1965. And that day, Marcy talked about letting go and letting God. And she said that you had to release the alcoholic with love. And if you didn't do it with love, it wouldn't work. And you know, this was the first time that I had ever heard that expression, releasing the alcoholic with love. And I really liked it. You know, we had talked about detachment. But to me, this had a little softer ring to it. And I loved it. And you know, with all the people in that forest that day, I really felt as though Marcy were talking directly to me, because, as I said, Tom was now sober a couple of years, and I had not let go of him, not one bit. As a matter of fact, you know, I was still trying to run his life, run his affairs, trying to tell him what he should do and what he shouldn't do. Poor little thing, I didn't think he was capable of making any decisions for himself, you know. And this caused a lot of arguments between us. I did not see it. I wasn't aware of it. And you know, of course, he hardly ever paid any attention to me. So here again, that left me, you know, in a state of frustration, thinking that he was being spiteful, looking for an argument because he didn't want to take my good suggestions. And so listening to Marcy that day in that forest, I realized today that I had my very first spiritual awakening. And I'm so grateful that God opened my mind for those few moments to allow me to see exactly what I was doing. And I realized that I was not helping Tom one bit. I was bucking him all the way. And at the same time, I remember glancing over at Tom out of the corner of my eye, and my heart just filled with so much love for him. And that hadn't happened for a long time either. And I knew right then and there that I didn't want to go on without Tom, and that I was going to have to really do something, and I was going to have to let go of him if I were going to find any happiness in my life. And so when we got back, I did a lot of crying that day, and I remember Tom, every time he tried to talk to me, I'd cry, and I just couldn't tell him, you know, what I had experienced that day. But when we got back from this conference, nobody had ever told me how to let go and let God. And so I began to pray about it. And I know today that anything I'm in doubt of, if I start it with a prayer, God always works it out for me. He has never failed me, truly. And I, at that time, I really didn't even know what to pray for. I know one thing, I quit praying for Tom Brown and I began to pray for Betty Brown. And the only thing I could think of at the time was to ask God to help me to become the kind of a person that he wanted me to be. Because I guess in my, I don't know, thick skull, I realized that if I could make myself pleasing to God, then certainly I'd have to be pleasing to the people around me. And it's a prayer I pray every morning when I get up. And you know, somewhere along the line, things started to get a little bit better between us. I wish I could go into more detail, but there's not time. And some nice things. We started to get happy together, and I started to get happy. And it was around this time that we moved to the area in which we live now, and there was no Al-Anon. And so another gal and I got together, and we started the Al-Anon group, which is my home group today. And I can't tell you how happy this has made me, because this time I jumped in and really got both feet wet and really became active. And Lord, did I get active. Of course, I just joke about that. I sometimes say my life has become unmanageable again because of too much activity. But I really don't mean it. That's the greatest part of my recovery. But I'm privileged to do a lot of sponsoring in our area and a lot of fifth step work. And if there's an Al-Anon committee, you name it, I'm usually on it. And a lot of you here know that more than 10 years ago, I rounded up some gals and started the first all Al-Anon roundup in the country. And that has been one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. And it has truly kept me happy. Through this program, I gained the knowledge about the disease of alcoholism that I had to learn. Once I accepted it, you know, as a disease, truly, it made it so much easier because I realized that Tom was not doing these things to me when he drank because he no longer loved me, but because he really was a sick person. And that compulsion to drink was greater than any promise he could have ever kept, you know, to me. I needed to know that. And it was through the Al-Anon program that eventually I was able to rid myself of all the negative junk that I carried around, the bitterness and the resentments for years. And I know that without Al-Anon, I probably would not have been aware of these things. And I was also able to learn to control my temper. Now, you know, that might not seem like a whole lot to you folks, but to me, that's wonderful progress for me because, as I told you, I had the most vicious, vile, violent kind of a temper that a woman could possibly have. And I know that that's an illness in itself. But as I told you, I would smash things and scream and yell and carry on. And one incident that always comes to my mind, I could tell you dozens of them. But one, you know, Tom has always been extremely proud of his automobiles, and he always drove nice cars, drunk or sober. He always had nice cars, and I've often said they were sometimes on the verge of being repossessed, you know, but anyhow, he always keeps them in tip-top shape, clean, and all that. One night he came home drunk, and he had a new car, I think it was 3 or 4 days old, whatever, and we got into one of our usual big arguments. And he said, "Ah, who needs this?" So he went to get his coat to go out to drink some more. And I ran out in the garage and I lifted the hood of that car and I ripped out every wire I could get my hands on. Just threw them all over the garage, all over the driveway, you know. And he came out and he turned white. And he said to me, "Betty, you are crazy." And you know, he was right. I really was crazy. And I've often said that I'm lucky, truly, that he wasn't really a violent guy, because he'd have sent me to the moon that night for sure. And then we talk about the insanity of this disease. Within 5 minutes, we made up and went in and we're looking through the yellow pages to find the cheapest tow truck to come and get the car, you know. And so this is the way, you know, it was going for us. And I could tell you things about my temper, running around the house one day with a loaded gun threatening to blow Tom's head off and holding it right against his head too, and he didn't move. Only because he really knew that I truly was insane. I really was crazy, and I may have pulled that trigger, and he sweet-talked me into putting it down, and I'm so grateful to God that nothing terrible happened. I don't know where the kids and I would be today. And so for me, when I tell you that I've learned to control that temper, that's wonderful progress for me. And it was through Al-Anon that I learned to forgive. And I don't mean for that to sound self-righteous, because believe me, I need so much forgiving of my own. But you know, when Tom was first new in AA, I used to say that there were some things that he did when he drank that I'd never forgive him for. And I said this to a good Al-Anon gal one time. And she said to me, "Betty, if you can't find it in your heart to forgive Tom, then how do you expect God to forgive you?" And I said, "For what? I haven't done anything." And she laughed, you know, and she said, "You know, Betty, we all have skeletons in our closets. We all have said and done things that we're not proud of. And if you can't forgive, then don't expect to be forgiven." And that really hit me between the eyes. I knew what she was saying was true. And that was a big help to me. And through the Al-Anon program, I eventually came to recognize the things in myself that were causing problems in our marriage. And I know, again, without a program to follow, I doubt very seriously whether I could have ever recognized these character defects in myself. So here again, I'm really grateful, and I had to learn to change my attitude about a lot of things. You know, I've always, as I told you, had such a big mouth, and I would say things and then regret them later because I said things out of anger or too quickly. And I've learned to think about things a little bit before I open my mouth, and that's good for me. You know, we were going on a vacation to Hawaii several years ago, and this was sort of when they first began to segregate the smokers from the non-smokers. And I remember I overheard Tom making the seating arrangements, and the man said, "Do you want to sit smoking or non-smoking?" And he immediately said, "Non-smoking." Well, that infuriated me because I smoke. And I thought to myself, why, that selfish guy, how could he do that without even asking me where I would like to sit, you know? And I really was burning. And we got seated, and Tom kept saying to me, "What's wrong?" And I'd say, "Nothing," waiting for the chance, you know. And as I sat there stewing, I yanked a magazine out of the pocket of the seat in front of me, flipped it open, and here was this picture of this beautiful butterfly. Well, of course, now we all know that the butterfly is not the Al-Anon symbol. Our logo is. However, the butterfly story has a very, very special meaning to me, and I love it. And somehow, it just seems to keep me in line for some reason or another. There have been many incidents where my nose was a little out of joint or whatever, and all of a sudden a pretty butterfly had almost landed on me, and it would remind me. It's a reminder for me. And in thinking about it, I came to the conclusion that really Tom was not the selfish one at all. I was the selfish one, because after all, he'd had the guts to quit smoking, you know, several years before, and I was still puffing away, and I knew how much smoke really bothered Tom in a very close area, and yet I expected him to sit in among all the smokers. And so, you know, this type of thing has happened to me many, many times. A change in my own attitude and thinking things out, you know. I could have spoiled the beginning of a very beautiful vacation. And so here again, I'm grateful. Today, Tom and I are growing spiritually together, and that's so nice. My conscious contact with my God today is a beautiful thing. And I talk to my God, as most of us do, every day. And you know, I don't know, several years ago, I was talking to my God privately, and I ended by saying, "Have a good day, Lord." And you know, I felt foolish. There was nobody around. But I don't know why. I just sort of felt foolish until I thought about it, and I thought, why not? I say that to my friends on the phone every day, and God's the best friend I will ever have. So why shouldn't I wish him a good day once in a while? And I like that. You know, today Tom and I are working together instead of pulling apart through AA and Al-Anon and the help of God. And a lot of you have heard Alpha from California describe AA and Al-Anon as a railroad track. She said, there you are, side by side, going straight ahead together with the same ultimate goal in mind, but with just enough space in between so as not to smother one another. And I really like that. You see, because I know that I was trying to smother Tom. I resented everything he did that did not include me. And today, in being able to let go and allow him to do some of the things that he enjoys doing, lo and behold, I found out that I can do some of the things that I enjoy too. And I always thought I wasn't allowed to do some of these things, you know? And so today we can both do our own thing, you know, within reason. He loves to golf. I used to resent it. And today I truly have released him with love. Oh, once in a while, you know. <laughs> 98% of the time I have released him with love. And it really has been very beautiful. And today I can stand here and tell you that I'm glad Tom's an alcoholic. And God, I never thought I'd ever say that, because one of the early AA meetings that we went to back home, a man in the back of the room stood up and he said, "I'm glad I'm an alcoholic." And frankly, I thought the guy drank too long. You know, I could not imagine anybody saying such a thing. But today I know, you know, what he was talking about, because if Tom were not an alcoholic, there'd be no AA or Al-Anon for us. And I'm sure that maybe we could have struggled through life, you know, with the same arguments and bickering and never ever knowing that there is a better and a happier way to live. And it's through these two beautiful programs. Our purpose in Al-Anon is threefold. It is to offer comfort, hope, and friendship to the families of compulsive drinkers. It is to learn to grow spiritually ourselves through living by the 12 steps of AA. And it is to give understanding and encouragement to our own alcoholic. And I always like to add love to that, because to me, it's the most important of all. And yet, for a period, a rather short period in my life, it was the hardest for me to give to Tom love. You know, when we were married, we were the most loving, affectionate couple toward one another. And through the alcoholism, as I told you, we drifted apart. And when Tom came into AA, I know today that he was trying to make his amends to me. And he would come to me and say, "Betty, I love you." And as much as I wanted to say it back to him, I don't know why, but it would stick right here and I couldn't get it out. And so I'd wind up saying things to him like, "Oh, I'm glad you do, Tom," you know, or "That's nice." And I could not say back to him, "I love you too." And I really did. I don't know whether it was a fear of rejection or false pride or what. And I talked about this with a good Al-Anon friend, and she said to me, Betty, you do love him. And I said, very much. And she said, well, then you must tell him. You need to tell him. He needs to know it, too. And so I knew she was right. And would you believe it that it took me 3 days to finally tell my husband that I loved him? And I had planned it in my mind for the first date. And when he got home, I got all nervous and my heart started to beat and I couldn't do it. And the second day, the same thing happened. And then finally, on the third day, when he got comfortable in his easy chair, I went right over and I plopped right down in his lap. And I might tell you, I weighed a whole lot less in those days. I'd break his knee today, probably. And I said, told him how much I loved him and that I really was proud of what he was trying to do with his life. And you know, it was as though a whole new world of communication, I guess, I might say, opened between us. And I know that by that time, I'm sure that Tom was getting sick and tired of always being the one to come to me, trying to make amends and being rejected. And you know, it was funny because sometime after that, this is the real switch, he said to me, you know, Betty, I was beginning to think that you didn't love me anymore, you know. And so if anybody's having a problem with that, please do it. You might feel a little vulnerable, but it is truly worth it because it became easier for us than for me anyway. Now, you know, I don't want to stand here and imply to you that everything is just roses in our home all the time and that we never ever fight or anything like that, because I wouldn't be very honest if I did that. Because you see, Tom and I still are very stubborn people, both self-willed, and so occasionally we don't always think alike, thank God. And sometimes we do get into an argument, but we don't even call them arguments anymore. They're loud discussions, really. Sounds better anyway. But these periods are fewer and farther between. And today, if we do have a disagreement, and sometimes we even raise our voices at one another or whatever, but it's all forgotten. Within 5 minutes, it's over and it's forgotten. And that is a miracle. Because when we had a fight years ago, you know, I wouldn't speak to him maybe for weeks and hold grudges and resentments and the whole bit. And that doesn't happen anymore. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, at least today, if we have a fight, at least today we fight fair. There's no more that hitting below the belt, bringing up the past, because I was famous for that. The first few years of Tom's sobriety, every time he got a little bit out of line, I'd bring up all the garbage and throw it at him, bring up the past. And I'm not proud of that either. That's the way it was. And so at least today, we are working together. And you know, Tom has always been much better at making amends than I. And even, you know, today, once in a while, if I'm feeling a little bit surly around the house, maybe looking for a little argument, he'll say to me, babe, life is too short. Let's be happy. And he's right. Life is too short. We should try to be happy and try to love one another just for today, because God only knows where we'll be tomorrow. And so I'd like to end my talk. Maybe I will tell you. You know, I told you that I quit drinking. And after Tom came into AA, for the first year or two, if we went somewhere, I might have a highball. And the last time I had a drink was probably, I don't know, 16 years ago maybe. And we were in Bermuda on a nice vacation, and we went to this swell restaurant, and the waiter came up, and he asked Tom and I what we'd like to drink. And Tom, of course, ordered coffee immediately. And so before the waiter could even ask me, Tom leaned over and he said, why don't you have a drink? And I said, no, I'll have coffee. He said, oh, go ahead, have a drink, it'll relax you. So I wasn't going to argue with the waiter standing there, and so I said, well, bring me a glass of champagne, because I always like champagne. And he brought one of those little split bottles, you know, and I drank it, and everything was beautiful. And about 2 weeks later, we were back home driving along in the car, and I lit up a cigarette, and the smoke blew right in Tom's face, and this caused a big argument between us, because this was about the time he quit smoking, too. And after several heated words back and forth, he said to me, I go on, he said, you drink and you, oh, you smoke and you drink. That's the way he put it. I said to him, don't you ever, you know, insist that I have a drink again. I choose not to drink. And I might tell you that that's brought a lot of happiness into our lives, because I just don't think that if I had continued to drink, perhaps we would not be as compatible as we are. As a matter of fact, I know we would not be as compatible. And I've seen this happen to people. I've had gals come to me and crying, saying they would do anything if only their husbands would quit drinking. And so he comes into AA and quits drinking, but she doesn't want to give up her own drinking. And now I'm not talking about somebody who takes an occasional highball or something like that, but someone who has a pattern of drinking themselves. And I just don't think it's fair. I wouldn't do anything to jeopardize the happiness that Tom and I have today. And so, as I said, I just choose not to drink, and we both like it that way very much. Today, Tom, I can tell you, he's a great guy. You know, I can stand up here and kid him. Tomorrow he'll be up here kidding about me, probably. And it's okay. It's great, because it's great to be able to do this, because 18 or 19 years ago, nothing was funny. We wouldn't dare kid one another about anything. And so we kind of like this sharing. Today, through AA, he's just a great guy. He's kind, and he's loving, and he's generous, and I really like that last one. And he wasn't any of these things before AA, but I wasn't so hot either. And so today, we truly are trying to work together and trying to rebuild our lives and get well together. And so I'd like to end my talk tonight by publicly thanking my God for all he's given me, for all he's done for us. And I always end by thanking all you wonderful AAs and Al-Anons who were there when we needed you, helped us all the way along. And I always end my talk by thanking my husband for staying sober, because without sobriety, we'd have nothing. Thank you.